When it comes to the lean executive recruiting landscape, staying ahead means staying informed. Subscribing to the Stiles Associates email list gives you access to the latest compensation data, industry analysis, and career resources straight from their recruiting team. Plus, you'll receive hand-picked career opportunities from leading companies, whether you're seeking new challenges or just curious about the market. So head over to leanexecs.com and sign up to get on the Stiles Associates email list and transform the way you make strategic decisions for your company and your career. Thanks for listening. Did you know I can help your organization on this journey of cultivating a culture of learning and innovation? I can be a trainer, coach, and advisor on topics including psychological safety, problem solving, and continuous improvement. I can add value to your management team meetings by speaking and facilitating discussions on these important topics. To learn more, visit markgraben.com or email me, mark@markgraben.com. Let's improve together.
Welcome to the Lean Blog Podcast. Visit our website at www.leanblog.org. Now, here's your host, Mark Graben.
Hi, everybody. It's Mark Graben. It's episode 461 for October 27th, 2022. My guest today is Gauthier Duval. He's the director of the Lean Center of Excellence at a company called Variable. So you will learn more about him in a minute. Later on, you'll hear more about his company. For links, you can look in the show notes for more information, or you can go to leanblog.org/461. Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Our guest today is Gauthier Duval. He's the director of the Lean Center of Excellence at a company called Variable, and that's spelled V-E-R-Y-A-B-L-E, if you want to go look them up online. But Gauthier has applied and taught Lean for over 18 years, including time with Freudenberg NOK, which is an auto supplier. They were one of the companies featured in the book Lean Thinking. He was with Simpler Consulting. He's done work with other manufacturing companies in the U.S. and Europe. So, Gauthier, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Thanks, Mark. I'm doing great. Thanks.
Well, I'm glad you're here today. There's a lot that we're going to dive into on topics, including Kaizen events and other forms of continuous improvement. But then we're going to talk about some issues involving organizational development and learning organizations. And I think it's going to be a really, really good discussion here today. But as I tend to do, Gauthier, I like to ask people, I kind of come to call it lean origin story. Like how, where, and when, what's your story where you got introduced to lean?
Yeah. My story, I won't say it's an introduction to lean, but it really framed lean for me ahead of time. And it was my very first real job. I was a management consultant in a steel company. And my particular area of responsibility was the tool preparation department. And I'd been given this objective to basically improve the productivity in there. I rapidly found out that the key here was not so much to look at the balance of workload to capacity, but actually the key was the changeover process. And so I had to kind of pivot and turn it into a changeover reduction process. Nevertheless, I mean, not at all. Again, I had no clue what lean was about, never heard the term lean or TPS before, but it was something that I had to engage in. And the funny part, and why I say this was kind of a framing episode for me, was at the report out where everybody presented their projects, the chairman of the company actually focused on this particular project, not so much for how much money it saved, but because he said, this is something that's going to improve our ability to sell higher margin products, but products that are in smaller batches, and therefore, you've opened that to us. That's the main value of what you've done. It was funny because neither I nor my project director had any clue that this was really the value of what our project was. So it was very eye-opening. And when I later learned about lean, I think it helped me to really immediately click and engage and just love the whole lean thing.
Yeah. So did you have lessons or coaching or resources of, you know, or kind of TPS or lean based on how to go about the changeover reduction? Like you kind of sounds like you had to kind of figure out how to go about it that way.
Yeah. I remember actually really struggling to see, okay, how am I going to do this? Because it's very complex, right? This is not a changeover on a machine. This is changeover on the largest steel rolling mill in Europe or even outside of Japan. And so if you're familiar with how we make steel beams, you start with a large slab of red hot steel, which gets hammered into a longer shape. And then that goes through the rolling mill. It basically goes through a series of gigantic steel drums or steel rollers that gradually shape the steel into an I-shaped beam. And so you have to think about what changeover means there. It means basically changing these multi-ton steel rollers. The radius of each one of those wheels is several feet. And it required something like 17 or 18 people to do the changeover. Mm.
Yeah. It sounds far more complex than changing the dies in a simple press machine or stamping machine. Not that those are simple, right? Yeah,
yeah. And on top of that, you also have to synchronize with movement of your overhead cranes, which are also used in the other parts of the process, like the saw. So it was very complex. I knew nothing about SMED, obviously. And so I used a PERT, program evaluation and review technique. And I remember making a precedence chart, a large piece of paper and just drawing out each and every little step and figuring out which one was a predecessor. Mm-hmm. And just figuring out this way, and then doing a Gantt chart. So it was not your usual SMED technique, but nevertheless, it achieved our goals.
Yeah, I mean, and it sounds like a couple of things come to mind. Like one, what I hear you describing, regardless of terminology we might use, is like the power of studying the work. Like I'm an industrial engineer, so I have a bias towards observing and deeply studying work and then thinking about what steps can be eliminated, rearranged. I mean, it sounds like, it's just kind of that discipline. There's helpful concepts that come from SMED, quote unquote. But I mean, it sounds like you went about this in a methodical way instead of like just looking for, you think of what other organizations might do. They didn't go look for a best practice. Like they were studying, here's how it works here. How do we make it better?
Yeah, there's really no shortcut for going into the details, getting your hands dirty, literally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the other thing that jumps out, I think, in your discussion of the context of that, it sounds like it wasn't improvement for the sake of cost cutting. It sounds like it was improvement to enable things like, you mentioned revenue, and it sounds like, maybe providing better customer service and growth in different ways, whether it's revenue or volume, providing more value. That's different than quote unquote cost cutting, right?
Correct. And that's why it was so meaningful to me, because initially my project was a pure cost cutting project. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I was asked to do. And that's kind of how I went about it with that objective. And then it was during the presentation or report out that all of a sudden, this chairman kind of really opened our eyes and showed us that there are things that are way more valuable to a company than just cutting costs.
Yeah, yeah. So then what was your progression? I mean, you kind of alluded to, or you said from that you didn't really know lean. You were doing things where you'd say, well, that was lean-ish, if you will. Like, yeah. So what were some of the different steps there where, you know, clearly you did get into that more formally. What happened next for you and for your learning?
Right. Yeah, this was really lean by accident. For me, it really started when I started working at Growth. So that was 2004. And at the time, we just moved actually to Europe. We were working in the States. My wife got transferred to Barcelona in Spain. And I just took up this job for consulting. And
real quick, and for context, Growth was kind of an offshoot from Freudenberg and OK, right?
Correct. Yeah, like Growth was the name of the lean office at Freudenberg and OK. It stands for get rid of waste through team harmony.
There's two T's in Growth.
The two T's are not a typo. There are two T's, yes.
Right.
And so it was very successful. They kind of spun it off as an independent consulting business, still keeping a lot of relationship with Freudenberg. I did a lot of Kaizen projects at Freudenberg because we still had that connection. But yeah, that was my real introduction to Lean because all we did really was we would do a Lean assessment followed by a number of projects.
And so it was sort of Growth had been an internal group that started doing consulting, but then occasionally also kind of consulted back.
Correct.
Freudenberg, yeah. Is that fair?
Yeah. It was that kind of agreement, gentleman's agreement between the two entities, even though, you know, we were truly independent companies.
And you joined there in 2004. Joe Day was featured.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Joe Day had been the CEO, and I looked up real quickly. He retired in 2002. He was mentioned quite a bit in Lean Thinking.
Yeah.
I've had a chance to meet him a couple of times, because of being featured in Lean Thinking. When I was at MIT, students, we invited him to come speak in 1998. When he was, still CEO. And I actually then ran across him probably in about 2014 or 2015 in his retirement. He was, let's just say, on the board of a health system in Florida. And I was there as a consultant, and I had an opportunity to reconnect and go have dinner with him. But, so he had already left. And I'm just curious, though, like what your recollections were anyway of the influence that he had that was hopefully, I'm assuming, still there.
Yeah.
2004-ish.
So I never had the pleasure of meeting Joe directly. One of my best colleagues and friends at Growth was very close to Joe. In fact, he was discovered by Joe. But, since my experience was with the European branch, we really didn't have many connections with the U.S., but I know that Joe was involved a digital transformation of the health system.
Yeah, and I think he was motivated to try to bring lean concepts, including lean leadership, into healthcare, and he was actually buddies with Jack Welch, because they were retired CEOs who, if I remember right, they played golf together, but different approaches to leadership, shall we say. And remember him, he had no disrespect for Jack Welch, but he just, there was recognition of, hey, there was a different leadership mindset and a different style of lean or otherwise there. But I want to get back to, you talk about going to Europe. What differences did you see in terms of trying to introduce lean, as much as you could generalize, Europe compared to the U.S.?
It's always difficult to generalize. I had the luck, actually, of traveling extensively as a consultant. So I traveled all over Europe to do different projects, as well as North America, Brazil, Mexico, Asia. And yeah, there are some real differences, at least from my personal experience. I always felt that doing a Kaizen project in the US was more rewarding, or let's say it was easier. My sense is that participants in the US come into a Kaizen project very open-minded, wanting to change. In Europe, it really feels like you're dragging them to their death. And there are some differences, you know, between, let's say, the Latin countries, France, Italy, Spain, and the Northern European countries. Yeah, I would say in Southern Europe, people come with kind of a very defensive approach, I would say, you know, and they'll kind of fight you every step of the way. But if you do manage to convince one or two key people, then you've won it. You know, I mean, it's very important to have that human connection and to work directly with people and show them what's in it for them, you know, that you're really trying to make their job easier. And once you've done that, you know, there are absolutely no issues. My experience with the Northern Europeans, like the Germans, it's quite of interesting that they're the most direct people I've ever met. Like, Germans will give you feedback that anywhere else would kind of sound like your head has been cut off.
Yeah.
They don't mean it in a bad way. They're just being objective and telling you exactly what they think.
Yeah.
And they don't sweeten it.
The Dutch also have a reputation, and they embrace this reputation as being blunt, direct,
very blunt.
You know, and you know, maybe they're that's interesting to think about in terms of, you know, there's a lot of lean healthcare activity in the Netherlands. I've had a chance to go a couple of times, and there probably is real value in that ability to be direct and to expect directness in a way where maybe it helps separate, you know, it's the difference between, you know, if you will, attacking an idea without the person you're debating the idea with feeling attacked personally. Yeah. You know, maybe that's a cultural norm that could be helpful if everyone's on the same page with that expectation. It's a little surprising sometimes coming in as a foreigner, somebody outside of that culture.
But. Yeah, and I don't want to make it sound like one model is better than the other. I think you can achieve your goals anywhere. You just have, like you said, it's about knowing what to expect and you know interacting with people according to those expectations, to those norms.
I mean, I was talking to somebody earlier, for an episode of My Favorite Mistake, a physician and a leader from Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. And the conversation wasn't so much about lean, but he was talking about, you know, what's often called Midwest nice, where people might be smiling and shaking their head and it looks like there's agreement, but when there's not, because people don't, again, we're generalizing, but this is a different cultural thing to try to battle through. What's the culture in our organization? Are we being superficially nice in a way that glosses over disagreements in a way that really kind of hurts us long term? Like, yeah, we don't have conflict, but like some level of conflict, if we can not have it be personalized, like that's necessary for improvement.
Yeah, I think a lot of Americans have felt that working in the UK, right? Uh-huh. Where what sounds like a very, very mild disagreement is actually a very strong and profound disagreement with you.
Yeah, where if you don't know that, you don't know some of that context, you might not understand then the level of disagreement.
And not take it seriously and ignore the person and what they're trying to tell you. And then that can rapidly devolve into something much more difficult to catch up
Yeah. So one other topic I wanted to ask you about, you know, from your experiences, you used the term Kaizen projects. You know, a lot of people would talk about Kaizen events.
Yeah.
Sometimes people say Kaizens when they mean Kaizen events. I think that's not a helpful shorthand. I'm curious, not just around terminology, but what are some of your thoughts around whether we call them quote unquote Kaizen projects, Kaizen events versus, you know, kind of more ongoing daily continuous improvement? What are some of your experiences and thoughts?
Yeah. Well, Mark, let's go back to what you said about terminology. I think terminology is supremely important. There are so many misunderstandings and so many cases where we have miscommunicated purely because we're using the same word and assigning different meanings to the word. And it's not just about Kaizen. It's, to me, one of my pet peeves is people using cycle time for lead time. But there are many, many other examples. And Kaizen, yeah, I agree, is one of those areas where if you don't necessarily have the same understanding of what the word means, you can rapidly misunderstand what the other person is telling you. So, for me, Kaizen is just anything that is an improvement. It doesn't matter what improvement has been done by somebody in a couple of minutes or whether it's a week-long event.
Yeah, on that real quick. Yeah, I think of Kaizen as sort of a overarching banner, a header. And then within that, to me, Kaizen events are a type of Kaizen. Small improvements, sometimes people call them just do it. So I like to call them just PDSA it's, you know, because we don't want to just do. Like whether it's an A3 or a Kaizen event or a small Kaizen, like to me, the common thread is plan, do, study, adjust cycles, mm-hmm. large, medium, or small.
Yeah, I mean, I did a project recently with a machining operation here in Dallas, and you know, we could have done it with a regular Kaizen event, multi-day, but it wasn't appropriate. And the best way to achieve the goals actually was to break it down, if you will, into just regular meetings every two or 3 weeks and define step by step, you know, what we're going to do. And then give people the opportunity to do those things while they are carrying on with their daily job. Because I think this is one of the major issues with implementation of Lean is it's too disruptive quite often. Sometimes we want it to be disruptive, and I think it's okay to disrupt the mindsets. You have to do that. But if you're disrupting your daily production or disrupting your daily operations, then you're basically asking for trouble. You're asking for people to basically, you're giving them the excuse to say, this is really not working for us, or this is not the right way to do it.
Yeah. And I think it would be a mistake for someone to be like a little bit too stubborn to say the only way to do improvement is the classical 5-day event. And then we see all kinds of adaptations. Shorter Kaizen events, if you're going to force everything to be 5 days, that could be wasteful. It could just kind of, you know, why is it not, it doesn't have to take that long. Or what you're describing, sometimes it's done a little bit more over time. But yeah. Similar thought process in terms of planning. You know, I think even the classic quote unquote week long Kaizen event, there's the planning time, then there's the event, and then there's follow up. It's never just a week.
Correct. I think it really comes from the consulting constraint, right? Because consultants have to basically fit everything into a week long trip. And so they kind of saw, at least that's been my experience.
Right? That's some of the history of it.
We sized our Kaizens so that they would fit within our travel schedule.
Yeah. But then there's always that hypothesis around sizing. We think, like, unless you've gotten really good at sizing it, there's two different errors. You could have chosen a problem that's too big,
yeah,
or you could have chosen a problem that was too small. So if it's too small,
I mean, I've had
end the event early, I guess, right?
Yeah, I've had plenty of variation in terms of what I achieved on those week-long events. Sometimes I didn't achieve my goals. Sometimes I went above. On average, it was about right. But yeah, the sizing is really difficult.
Yeah. I mean, even with experience, there are things that you don't know, and maybe you get better at testing assumptions to make sure that you're not surprised by things that you didn't know.
Well, but you mentioned the preparation phase, right? And I think that's what a lot of lean practitioners have learned to do, is to spend 3 or 4 weeks prior to the event itself in preparation. And that certainly is a big help in terms of making sure that you don't have large deviations. I think for consultants, it's a bit more difficult to do that.
If you're outsiders, yeah.
You're outsiders. And basically when you're working purely, often you're purely working on the delivery phase, and there's very little time left for preparation and follow-up, which I think is a shame, really. But
Do you think outside consultants tend to try to direct internal folks to do the prep and the follow-up then?
That's been my experience. Mm-hmm. And it works, you know, it depends who your internal clients are. If they have some prior experience of Kaizen, that works fine. But if you're dealing with a client who is just starting on their lean journey and they do not have experienced people to do this prep work and the follow-up work, then that becomes an issue.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, there's growing pains in terms of the learning by doing, where, you know, hopefully people are given an opportunity to learn from mistakes, to learn from their experience. Like, to me, we'd love to quote unquote do it right the first time. But that's not, I mean, that's maybe that's not always possible on complex things.
I think, you know, good consultants will manage expectations based on what they know is going to happen. So again, I mean, you're not going to provide the same expectations to a company that is at the very beginning of the journey as opposed to one that is midway or is somewhat mature.
Yeah. So one other thing I wanted to ask you about Kaizen events, to use that term, in terms of getting, you know, deciding who should be participating, and then in particular, the ideal role for a senior leader.
Yeah, I think it's always good to have managers and leaders in Kaizen, simply because you don't learn just through theory. You have to actually live through the event and understand how the team members change their perception of what is possible. For me, regardless of how the event turns out in terms of what results you've achieved, one of your key goals as a facilitator is, have I changed people's mind? Have I changed their expectation of what can be done? And if you've done that, then you've achieved a lot in terms of mindset, in terms of culture. So for me, it's really important that the leadership, especially top leadership, has that experience. Sometimes it's a bit difficult, though, because I think the biggest culture change actually is for the top leadership, from moving from being the person who provides the answer to everything and who provides the direction and tells people what to do, to being the listener. That's sometimes a very, very big change.
So what happens if you're in an event and senior leader is kind of falling back into some of those habits? You ever have to pull them aside or try to provide some coaching or reminders? I mean, that's got to be awkward at times.
It is kind of awkward. It's the big difference between being a consultant and being an internal lean person. So as a consultant, you don't have the fear, I think, of confronting your boss, since that person is not your boss. I try to treat everybody exactly the same way. It doesn't matter whether it is a team member who is disrupting the work or whether it is the CEO. You have to treat them the same way. And that's the whole point, actually. I don't know if you do this when you do your Kaizen events, but I always start with what rules do we want to play with or play by? And I don't set the rules. It has to be coming from the team themselves. Of course, as a facilitator, even though you don't set the rules, you do have a great deal of influence on what mm-hmm. rules the team works with. But having said that, I did have actually, it's only been once in my entire lean career, but I did have one case where I actually had to fire, and it was the president of the company, by the way. I'd fire the president of the company from his own Kaizen.
To kick really not funny. I mean, he wasn't kicking him out of the event.
Basically. Yeah, I'm saying fire, but really it was just saying, I think it would be best for you not to come back tomorrow.
And what was the behavior that prompted you to do that?
The behavior was just that this person was so controlling that this person was basically taking over the entire Kaizen and not letting others speak and really monopolizing the whole Kaizen event, which was obviously antithetical to the whole concept of Kaizen. So after trying, as smoothly as I could to give him just private one-on-one feedback during the break, and he said, yes, I will. I understand. Not changing his behavior. I mean, it took me 2 days. I really struggled with, do I do this or not? But actually, it turned out to be a good decision. I was, as I said, I was pretty much afraid of what would happen. But the effect on the rest of the team members was amazing. This is like the team members all of a sudden blossomed and did a fantastic work.
So how did that leader take this news? Like, did they stop off? Did they argue with you about it? Did they kind of like, yeah, okay. Did they begrudgingly accept that?
In this case, the leader was obviously not happy. I would say really in the end, it didn't change his behavior much.
So. Beyond the event, it didn't change the behavior.
Correct. I mean, he was already not exactly cooperative, but he was not the top client. The top client was in Germany.
So it wasn't his decision to either kick you out.
It could have been also why he wasn't very cooperative to begin with. Wasn't his decision to have our team in his company.
Well, so that possibility raises, some interesting ideas around the acceptance of change. I mean, if they were being told to do this, there's some basic psychology around people. If you're going to tell me to do it, I'm going to, push. There's almost this reflex to push back.
Yeah.
Against being told to do something. So I wonder, there might have been some opportunity even within that organization, within that enterprise, to better engage that leader than they might have been willing or able to embrace this more.
Yes, I would say, I think it's, I think it is something that any lean person has to learn more about is the whole field of organizational development. I think it is so important. If you're trying to do a lean transformation, that you really understand what's what change means and how organizations behave and how the organizational structure and the organizational culture drives the behavior of the people that you work with. I feel that a lot of our lean colleagues don't pay enough attention to organizational development.
And that phrase, and I think we can dig deeper into that. Toyota uses the phrase organizational development or OD. Mm-hmm. A lot of the former Toyota people that I've worked with in various capacities or learned from, very many of them were from the OD part of Toyota. In your experience, even more broadly, how is OD as a a concept or a department different than HR and human resources?
Oh, that's a great topic, Mark. I feel that one of the weaknesses of OD is that it's really HR. I mean, it is very much an HR thing. And I think that's, I mean, I'm not an OD practitioner, but I think it hurts OD to be, you know, to be stuck to this HR department. I always feel, at least in my interactions in the past with OD people, that they would really benefit from reaching out and working more closely with their operational excellence or continuous improvement colleagues.
So it sounds like there's kind of an opportunity to bridge that gap coming a little bit from both directions. Lean people.
I wish. Yes.
Okay, reach out to OD. OD, reach out to lean or operational excellence. There's, you know, back to terminology, there's all kinds of different terms. But like when you talk about the benefits of why building that bridge how would you explain the why and the benefits from doing that?
The way I would explain it is OD ought to be a foundational practice for lean. In other words, if we think about the sequence of implementation, I believe we ought to start with OD and then begin the lean program. And I think that a lot of, you know, we all know that a lot of lean initiatives don't end up meeting expectations. And I don't know if you want to qualify them as straight out failures or semi-failures, but it's a fact that a lot of lean initiatives don't work out very well. And in the lessons learned, we always talk about leadership was not on board or the mindset was not on board. Well, that's all OD. And I think that, you know, we have to start with the beginning, and that's really working hand in hand with the OD specialists and practitioners.
Yeah. Comes back to this is becoming a running theme of terminology and definitions. Like, how do you define failure if it's a quote unquote failure? You know, there are different numbers thrown around. It feels like I'm sharing a pet peeve now of numbers thrown around of, you know, whatever X percent of lean initiatives fail. I'm like, well, what do you mean by fail? And I think, you know, this number sort of points back, like, if I remember right, the more precise terminology was something around did not meet expectations. Well, that's different, right?
Yeah,
not meeting expectations versus failing. And then it steps back and, you know, you step back and ask, well, were the expectations unrealistic or not? So, you know, if we're loose with our terminology around these things, you know,
if your expectation is that you're going to become your industry's Toyota, maybe that's
or how quickly, right?
And how quickly,
maybe,
yeah.
Maybe absolutely. You could do that, but it's not a 6-month project, right?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
It's probably not. Yeah. You know, back to, you know, terminology and phrases that get thrown around. I mean, the word lean itself, 10 different organizations that would say we're quote unquote implementing lean. You could ask what does implementing mean? And they might be doing any range of things that are very different, you know, kind of, you know, full holistic lean model, if you will, versus like, oh, we're using some lean tools. Like those are not one and the same. Another term that gets thrown around, maybe sometimes loosely, is learning organization. And I know that's something that's important to you. Like how would you define that term? Like what do you think that term should really mean, like more specifically?
Yeah, I think that, you know, talking about expectations and goals, I believe that from an OD perspective, that's the goal, is that we become a learning organization. What it means for me is the ability for the organization to discuss threats without becoming defensive. I think when you look about when you look at companies that have really truly failed, right? It's not because they were not aware of the threats that ultimately killed them. It's because being aware of the threats, they decided either to suppress discussion about it or to pursue one way without then questioning that one way. When we talk about learning organization, for me, there's one person who really embodies a great understanding of what it means to become a learning organization, and that's Chris Argyris. I mean, if you were to ask me who are my top gurus, right? I mean, obviously, I'd say Ono for Lean and Drucker for strategy management and Deming for systems thinking. But when it comes to the organization and the culture, I would put Argyris as my top inspiration. And even though I'll be upfront, you know, I encourage everybody on the podcast to go and read Chris Argyris. Mm-hmm. His books are not exactly an easy read. I mean, it's very academic in the style, but it's full of insights and full of really important ideas.
So I've heard the name. I am more familiar with the work of Peter Senge, who's also one of the first names that comes to mind, I think, in terms of systems thinking, learning organization. So tell us more about like what stands out to you from the work of Chris Argyris and tell us a little bit more about why people should be reading his work and the connections that they might draw out that are useful.
So Chris Argyris, first of all, to give you some context, he was, I believe, the dean of the College of Business at Harvard. So very, very distinguished researcher and practitioner. And what he wrote about was how what he called the defensive mindset, he called it a Model 1 mindset, how that's basically drove the way organizations are structured and how the way these organizations are structured also reinforces the mindset. So he was also very much a systems thinker because he identified all of those feedback loops within the organization. And, he really understood how that defensive mindset was so integrated into the way we think that we perform according to that mindset. I would say without ever thinking about it because it is automatic. So Argyris formalized this defensive mindset. By the way, it started very very much by accident. It started with him doing some studies, I think it was with government workers, and realizing when he was analyzing these studies that he did, that everybody behaved and thought in the exact same way. And this way was really what he called the defensive thinking mindset. It starts with the idea that we all have certain governing values that are inculcated right from the start. Like one of the reasons why we all have this common Model 1 defensive mindset, according to Argyris, is we acquire that during childhood. And all children go through the same phase, which is if you're a child, you basically have no power, right? You are dependent on others for everything. And so the survival mechanism for a child is to develop these action strategies that work very well, but those, of course, as an adult, don't work so well if you are in a situation where you need to learn, you need to change. So if you think about these governing values that drive defensive mindsets, they're things that I think would be accepted by everybody. It's, you achieve your goals, but you achieve your goals through unilateral control. In other words, you don't depend on others to achieve your goals. You want to maximize your winning and you want to minimize your losing. You want to suppress negative feelings and you want to be perceived as acting rational, right? I mean, it's not controversial. Everybody will say, yeah, that makes sense. Where it becomes interesting is what kind of action strategies we have developed and internalized so that it's now a habit that we, the way we achieve those governing values through the action strategies are things like, I'm going to advocate for my position, but I'm going to do so in a way that does not invite you to test my assumptions or my reasoning in any way. I'm going to evaluate you, or I'm going to make attributions about your thoughts, but I'm not going to test those, right? Because just in the way that I'm kind of keeping things to myself, I know that you're keeping things to yourself. Therefore, the only way I can understand you is by making evaluations and attributions. So there are a whole series of action strategies that we develop and internalize. And those action strategies, even though they work very well, if you're in a routine situation, if you're in a situation where you have to deal with real threats, then they're totally counterproductive. And so he called this incompetence. He called it skilled incompetence because we become very skilled at these action strategies, but they make us incompetent when it comes to being able to learn from our errors.
Yeah. Wow. There's a lot to think about there.
It's a lot, yeah.
The word threat, is that referring to, let's say, external threats to the business or anything that's like interpersonally threatening? Like a problem.
It's the whole range, but ultimately, ultimately it is about how I, as an individual, perceive what you're telling me or what you're doing as I perceive it as a threat or I perceive it as a potential embarrassment.
Okay.
So if you say something that would perhaps embarrass me, I'm going to try to suppress that.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm not going to volunteer any information to you that would in return embarrass me or that would threaten my goals.
Yeah. So is that reaction, that defensive mindset, is it similar to what people might call knee-jerk reactions, or thinking of, is it related to Daniel Kahneman, who talks about type one thinking and type two thinking, or fast thinking and slow thinking? Is this sort of like knee-jerk, fast thinking responses?
So, yeah, I don't think it's the same thing as the system one, system two of Kahneman. I would really separate the two. But it is knee-jerk in the sense that, again, it's been internalized that we perform this behavior without even thinking about it. And one of the countermeasures that Argyris has developed, because, of course, he talks about this model one mindset. The solution to that model one mindset is not to do the opposite. The solution is to develop a new set of habits, of mental habits, which he calls model two. And one of the things that he explains, is it's really like, it's a bit like learning tennis, he says. It's about the same level of effort and practice over a month. But if you practice it every day, then you're going to be able to acquire those new habits. And the idea is not that this replaces the old mindsets. The old mindset still has its place. When you're in a routine situation, it works fine. It's when you are in those special situations where the organization or yourself or your team, you need to learn and you need to address something that is perceived as a threat. Then you have to use those new habits.
Yeah.
And he says, one of the things you do, one of the habits is to slow down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So resist your temptation to immediately come back with an answer. Slow mm-hmm. down your thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, that gives me pause. I'll think about that later instead of pausing and thinking about it now. But it also makes me think a little bit of the one time I saw the late Stephen Covey speak in person at a Shingo Institute event. One of the he was talking about one of his themes of putting a gap between stimulus and response. sounds similar to some of what you're making me think.
I think
about
that was a quote from Viktor Frankl, actually.
Yes, actually.
Between stimulus and response, there's a space, and that space is where your liberty lies, or something like that. I don't remember the exact quote, but a very, very striking quote, yes.
Yeah, and you're right. Covey did credit him. But I think, you know, Covey, I remember him adding, you know, some thoughts about thinking of, you know, how do we, what can we do in terms of behaviors and habits to make sure that that space is there, of not shrinking that space to where it really becomes just reflexive stimulus and response, and, allowing higher order thinking to rule instead of our reptile brain, as it's sometimes called, right? Fight and flight, fight or flight response, and traps that we fall into. A lot to think about there. So our guest again today, Gauthier Duval, wanted to ask you, tell us a little bit about Variable, the company. The website is variableops.com, V-E-R-Y-A-B-L-E, ops.com. Tell us about the company. What are the problems that you solve?
So the problem we solve is, how do you apply just-in-time beyond materials? You know, you have three factors of production, as we all know. We've got, to do anything, you need materials, you need people, and you need equipment. And lean today, as it's structured, is predicated on the idea that neither labor nor equipment are truly flexible, and therefore we do leveling. And what Variable does is really, it is a digital marketplace that connects businesses with operators, or really independent contractors. But it's really shrinking the batch size of labor acquisition, if you will, to the extent that now the batch size is, I need one person or I need five people for one shift, and I need them in 3 hours. And so it's really the ability for businesses to scale their labor capacity up and down to meet their demand, which is really what just-in-time is about, right?
The right people in the right place in the right time.
Exactly.
So how is that different? You know, Toyota uses temporary labor, but I think it's usually more of an extended contract, but without the guarantee of quote unquote, permanent employment, or, you know, Toyota will in downtimes let go contract labor while protecting full-time jobs. How does this fit into concepts like that?
Yeah, so we are absolutely not a staffing agency or a temp agency. We're absolutely not that, because the way we create the digital marketplace is that you as a business get to choose who goes into, we call it a labor pool. So you basically contract with operators and you rate those operators, just like, you know, Uber rates a driver. So you find the operators that you need, and those that you like, you then put into a labor pool. And the idea is that this labor pool is like the equivalent of a supermarket, but it's for labor. And you pull from that labor pool when and where you need labor. So it's a very, very different model than the temp model. So yeah, we are absolutely not about staffing.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious to think a little bit more a use case of, in talking about customers or clients, what types of companies would utilize labor? Is how skilled are we looking at, you know, relatively unskilled roles, or like what's the range of labor within these labor pools or markets?
It is for now, at least it's general labor, right? And we work only for industrial and logistics customers. So we specialize in industry and logistics. But yes, a lot of our people on the operator side are just general labor. So we don't have consultants, for instance, on the platform. It's an hourly labor.
And would that labor pool have an expectation? What would their expectations be in terms of how much work they would have over the course of the week or how many different environments they might be in over time?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Mark, because I think one of the reasons we're doing quite well in terms of growing, I mean, we're in the U.S., mostly in Southwest, Southeast, Midwest, and now starting in the Northeast, is a lot of the workforce today values flexibility above all. Not everybody, but there's a large number of workers who have just been treated so poorly, I think, in terms of being imposed overtime for long and long periods. And they've said, I don't want to work every weekend. I don't want to have overtime every day. And so a lot of them, and some of them also have family, you know, family responsibilities or family reasons for not wanting to have a full-time job. So for various reasons, there's a large number of workers today who are not looking for full time. And that's the kind of people you'll find on the platform.
Yeah. So is it set up in a way that it sounds like the intent is for it to be win-win, not just for the companies utilizing labor on demand, but also for the people providing their labor and.
Correct. And by the way, I mean, the rate at which the op, we call it an op, is priced, it's a market situation. So, I mean, if I'm an operator and I have a minimum threshold, then I'm going to look for only ops that meet my earnings threshold. And I can, by the way, I can also respond to a business bidding, offering an op with a counter bid or say, well, I'll do it, but I want to pay that much.
Yeah. So is there the equivalent? I mean, as a Uber user, sometimes you get hit by surge pricing. Is there a similar concept then within that?
Nothing like surge pricing, no fees. No, I mean, we take a percentage basically, but there's no obligation, no commitment on either side.
Yeah.
And as opposed to Uber, I can actually counterbid. So if I want to take the ride at a certain price, I can say I'll take you as a driver at that price.
Okay, well, it's very interesting. It sounds like it's a unique model and something for organizations where, like you said, if they can't level load in different ways, depending on customer needs, customer delivery requirements, this provides maybe a different degree of flexibility, not just materials, but people. You're not doing anything on the equipment space on that third piece?
We're not doing anything, but there's nothing really that prevents this concept of using digital marketplaces to mm-hmm. extend. It's really about extending the concept of just in time.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I guess, final question when it comes down to, engaging employees. I mean, it seems like there could be a possibility here of you think of what somebody from a labor pool is bringing into your company, not just the ability to follow a job instruction, but to participate in improvement. I'm wondering what your experience or what your intent would be in terms of using the minds of people who are getting placed into into something through Variable.
Yeah, I mean, I love that because. I don't know if you've had the same experience, but I've always had the experience that the people who are most creative and who bring the best ideas are usually in their first few months of employment, new employees.
Fresh eyes.
If I can get them into a Kaizen, I will definitely do that because they usually burst with ideas. I think that's always the issue when you go every day in and day out in the same environment, you kind of lose that that cutting edge.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would hope companies in any industry or any setting are open to learning from new employees or temporary employees. I've run across the two alternatives in healthcare to make it black or white. I remember talking to a quote-unquote traveler, they'll use that term in healthcare, contract person, medical technologist, was working in this hospital laboratory. And, you know, I'm there as a consultant. I am engaging people and trying to understand the culture and getting them to participate in improvement. And I remember this guy lamenting, you know, he would work at places for a couple months at a time. And he's like, yeah, I mean, he had such a breadth of experiences in different organizations to have ideas to bring in from the outside. And he's like, yeah, nobody would ask him for that input. And it's just, it's an example of, I think, wasting talent, wasting human potential. And I have been in organizations that very consciously and intentionally say, basically, hey, you're new here. You're going to see things that we are now situationally unaware of. If something is confusing or seem like please point out anything. There might be a good reason why we do it this way, but you also might be highlighting, hey, we've missed that. Here's a Kaizen opportunity. And boy, that is something organizations are better off for tapping into.
Yeah.
So I will climb down from my soapbox and we will come in for a dismount on the episode here. So again, we've been joined by Gauthier Duval, the director of the Lean Center of Excellence at Variable. And I encourage you, if you want to learn more about them or their model, go to variableops.com. There'll be a link in the show notes. And, Gauthier, if people want to reach out to you and learn more about this, if they want to talk to you about it, what's the best way to reach you?
Well, you can go to the website, variableops.com. And there's you can reach me directly there. There's a form to contact me, contact the Lean Center of Excellence. We're doing all kinds of very interesting experiments trying to create new tools for lean as it relates to labor.
All right. Well, I hope some folks reach out to you. Gauthier, it's been nice getting to know you through the process of prepping for the episode and doing it here today. So thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Lean Blog Podcast. For lean news and commentary updated daily, visit www.leanblog.org. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, email Mark at leanpodcast@gmail.com.
Hey, podcast listeners. I'm excited to announce the release of the audiobook version of my new book, The Mistakes That Make Us, Cultivating a Culture of Learning and Innovation. Listen and dive into powerful insights on fostering growth through mistakes. Whether you're a leader, entrepreneur, or just trying to get better at learning from mistakes, this audiobook is for you. Get it now on Audible, Amazon, and Apple Books. Visit mistakesbook.com for more info.